The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello, this is Dave here with a production note for this episode. Unfortunately, we had a technical snafu during game time, so we will be playing in that game time another episode. Apologies to Meredith, but we will definitely get back to that submission. Also, if you are a Patreon member and you're not on Discord and you don't know how to do that, good news, I'm hosting a series of tutorials August 3rd. That is Wednesday, August 3rd. All you need to do is just show up to one of four sessions during the day. It'll probably take 5 or 10 minutes. And then bam, you'll be on Discord. You'll be able to talk to us and your fellow listeners. It's definitely where most of the conversation about the podcast and all the pop culture stuff we talk about has migrated. Check the show notes for that link to find out how you can get on that Zoom tutorial to learn about how to connect Discord to Patreon. And now on with the show.
Hello. You've seen the show before. You know how we do.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 417 for the week of July 25th, 2022. I am Toilet Side Water Cooler David T. Cole, and I'm here with Code Violation Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, lawsuit.
Faux Fur Toilet Seat Cover Tar Ariano.
Jeremy.
And Triangle Drawers Allison Herman.
Deeply cursed.
Hello. You already heard her name up top, but officially welcoming her in. She is the TV critic at The Ringer. You've heard her here before. Allison Herman, welcome.
Welcome back, Allison.
Allison. Thank you for having me.
Yay! We're here to talk about the ugliest house in America, not by our judgment. That is the title of a show on HGTV. It's probably exactly what you think it is. American homeowners nominate themselves to be featured on the show, not just so we will all laugh and point at them, but so that they can be entered for a chance to win a $150,000 home makeover from Allison Victoria of Windy City Rehab. And Retta, formerly of Parks and Recreation and Good Girls, is our host, touring these poor idiots' houses and giving them the roasting they richly deserve. Each episode this season is located in a specific U.S. region in Paradise. 2 half-hour episodes aired Sunday night. That is all we've seen. We're going to spoil them, whatever that means for a show like this. So let's do the Chen check-in. Allison, should our listeners watch The Ugliest House in America?
If they want to think about America's housing crisis, they sure can.
Sarah?
Yes, unless, like me, they spent 7 years living in and renovating a money pit with the previous owner living next door, in which case this could be triggering, but generally, yes.
Dave?
Yes, it has high Looky Lou energy, which I enjoy.
Yes. Yeah, yes, if you like to judge people on house shows, this is the show for you. Allison, what is your level of engagement with home or lifestyle media?
I watch a lot of home renovation TikToks. I don't know if that counts.
Sure.
I am also a fan of Selling Sunset. As a resident of Los Angeles, I find it a portal into a different universe. But I am generally not clued into the HGTV CU, which is its own self-contained entity.
So what do you look for in media in this category? And even if this is not usually the kind of thing that you consume, did Ugliest House in America supply it for you?
I mean, you mentioned this earlier, but I look to mercilessly judge people on their aesthetic choices, which happens a lot on Selling Sunset, and kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum also happens in the show. Although I was kind of grateful that you're less judging the buyers and you're more judging like whoever cursed them with this house by
yes.
building it.
Mm-hmm. It's the sellers in every case. Yeah, there's an HGTV show called You Live in What? And this is like the next generation of that, where like the people who proudly showed off their weird houses like offloaded it to these idiots. And now they're like, why is everything like this? So we'll get into the details. Sarah, you already called this out in your intro. You're also married to a real estate agent. I felt sure you would have thoughts on this. In many of these instances, the issue is less the house is ugly than that it is structurally unsound.
Yeah. I mean, like my now husband on our second date, while tumbling down the front steps of the house I lived in, at that time was like, you know, these aren't up to code. I mean, that could, but he could have been talking about any element
Take
of
me
that
now.
Property. Yeah. I mean, it's like, we did get married in the backyard, so it apparently wasn't that bad. But mm-hmm. yeah, there were a lot of previous owners who made a lot of choices, many of them fueled by peyote, apparently. And then mm-hmm. they like live next door. So you're like, eh-heh-heh-heh. And every time you do a renovation, they're, you know, out front with their arms folded. Like something I said, like, well, no, but like we live in like a hole, or there's no drainage, or the rock house. I mean, it's just a lot. I'm also a very clumsy person. So that first house in the first episode where Retta's like, you can't be drunk or sleepy or you're dead. And I was like, yeah, just even looking at that, I think I sprained something with all the different levels and chakras and stuff. But mm-hmm. as someone who also watched Million Dollar Listings, LA and New York for a while before, you know, Reader, I married it. This did give me sort of vicarious anxiety.
Yeah.
For people, I mean, there's no pricing involved. And I think Retta is a perfect host for this. Like, mm-hmm. she's funny enough, but she's not mean. And they pick people who get it and are not going to be offended when, you know, the writing is making jokes at their/the house's expense.
Yeah.
I think it's good in that regard. And I think it's also a good one to, like, marathon on, like, when you have family around. I think it's sort of funny. There's kids in it, you know, little Chirons that are funny. I think it's good. But what I kept thinking was like, oh, this is what Quibi should have been doing. Remove the competition element and just have these like 6 to 8 minute segments about these hideous, unsafe houses and how many code violations have been reported. And then roll credits.
Right. You mean murder houses didn't do it for you?
I mean, it didn't not do it for me.
Mm-hmm. Fair.
It actually didn't, but there were other problems with that. And I won't return to kick the dead dog.
But I mean, one of these is certainly a murder house, but we'll drill down on each of them, as it were. In terms of the pricing, I agree. They don't tell you what, you know, the house in Montana was sold for versus the houses in Florida on a weird canal or whatever. But it does seem like most of what we see, $150,000 is not going to be enough to fix everything. It's going to be like Property Brothers, where they're like, we fixed two rooms. All right, just look at these. Okay, bye. You're on your own for the rest of it.
There's one house, the Red Rock House, where mm-hmm. they actually didn't pour a foundation. They just built the house over the dirt.
Yeah.
And they actually show them walking over the laminate floors, which like bulge and move with the dirt underneath them.
And there's like no electrical above the first floor, and even that is like one outlet with a nest of extension. Oh god, yeah. I can't. Flashbacks. I can't.
I think that renovation is probably just going to be like a straight demolition job, and they're like going to build a house next to the rock and be like, it's the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a lost cause on a lot of these. And, you know, because so many of them, of these ugly houses, are just, in fact, poorly constructed nightmares, it mm-hmm. becomes untenable to actually fix these for $150,000. Like, these are teardowns or near teardowns. It's, mm-hmm. it's
well, the repair
crazy.
Is for, like, a down payment on another house.
Right.
Right. Like, that's what I do. To be like, yeah, let's not live anywhere near here anymore. Bye.
Yes. Paradise or no. Yes, it's a nice view, but at what cost? literally at what cost. So let's go through the houses because they are all crazy. The first episode is in the mountain region. We start with what they're calling levels on levels on levels, or fuck your ADA. Allison, what was your feeling about this very first house that we saw?
My first thought was this makes a lot of sense in Colorado, especially mm-hmm. once the Chiron added that the reason it has seven levels is not just that they kept adding everything on in phases, although that's part of it, it's that they're supposed to represent the seven chakras. And mm-hmm. I was like, if there is a state where I believe that someone would make that choice for that reason,
absolutely,
it's Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bet we get some of that when they get to Hawaii, too, which you know they're going to if it's a paradise season.
I took the other tact, which was this guy who originally built this house that this family bought for whatever reason. They sort of painted him as a guy, and they said whenever he had enough money or random construction materials, he would just build an addition somewhere in his house. And then it came time, he needed to move, maybe he died, whatever. The real estate agent's like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. Seven-leveled monstrosity. I know I'm going to put there's something about chakras in their listing. I think that's it, because everything about the house didn't really speak to me about someone who was like really into chakras. Mm-hmm. Like it really just yeah. seemed like the best case.
Yeah, that definitely gave me a like cheap Jack hoarder Winchester house vibe. But I wasn't surprised at its fate at the end. But I'm getting ahead of us.
I will say this is a joke for five people, and one of them is on this Zoom. This was the Yahoo CMS in-house form, where it's like multiple different phases all happened. They never were harmonized, and so uh-huh. every place you go works in a different way. And I'm sure yeah. Yahoo is not unique in this respect. Lots of CMS, same thing, where instead of just starting anew, you just add a new thing on and hope for the best. Allison's shaking her head. She knows.
NBC Universal, same.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say the Kinja of houses.
Uh-huh.
There it is.
All right. Anything else to say about Stairhouse?
Just I don't think we've done the nexus of the house any justice yet, because it really is. There's like two rooms and like two staircases all converging in this one area that literally, it's like stairs threw up and blew up at the same time.
Yes.
It really is non-navigable. It really is like an ankle buster. Like there's no way you're going to live a year in this house without somebody falling and really hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm. Falling is an extremely common cause of death, and people don't appreciate like how dangerous this is because of Ivana Trump, but they're like, people don't understand that like healthy and like not even exceptionally old people die by falling all the time. And that was like 2 days before I watched this episode.
Oh God.
So. Definitely felt the bottom drop out of my stomach a little bit.
All right, let's move on to the Jailhouse Rock. I was not mad at this one until we got inside and saw the spongy floor. So the idea of this one is like there's a, you know, a rock face basically in wherever they are, Colorado. And they built this kind of cinder block, featureless, you know, apartment stack essentially beside and on it, so that part of the rock is inside the house. But this is the one that we've already talked about that had the spongy floors because there was no subfloor. And this is also the one where we see Retta outside with one foot on a block because the ground isn't level. And I want to note, she had knee replacement surgery within the last 5 years. So every time they went to one of these houses that was not all on one level, I was like really concerned for her. But, you know, she does a high kick. I guess she's better now, but still I was alarmed by this. Allison, your thoughts on Jailhouse Rock?
I believe this is the house where the Chiron specifically states, like, it was a really good price for the region, which, mm-hmm. you know, wonder why. But maybe this is a good place to do my pocket rant that I alluded to earlier, which is, you know, all of these houses, they talk about how they were bought for under asking or they were relatively cheap. And kind of in the opposite way where I'm watching, whenever I watch Selling Sunset, I can just think of like how deep the unhoused crisis is here in Los Angeles while we're watching these mansions. And this is, I was watching and was like, it's so hard to buy a house in America right now that these poor people were stuck with these monstrosities. And the Rock House specifically was like clearly a nice older couple who like wanted a place to retire and are now dealing with sub-freezing temperatures at night because there's no electrical. I felt very bad for them and very sad for the state of affairs.
Yeah, Richard Lawson had a piece a couple of years ago in Vanity Fair that we'll link in the show notes that was sort of about the, you know, HGTV as cover for gentrification culture and how
you know, HGTV is like secretly or not so secretly part of the problem. And this was like less an issue for me in this case, because it's more about the like, look at this craziness. But you're totally right that this is the miasma underneath everything that we're watching.
I don't judge them for the house, obviously, because they didn't build it. I judge them for buying it because they saw it, yeah. Including the fact there was like two outlets on one floor and then like just like snaking extension cords up to everywhere else so they can use it. Like the guy couldn't figure out how to get electricity up. So they just put all the power on the ground floor and they're like literally extension cords to power probably very important things in their lives. Like, I didn't mind the rock part of it sticking in there. Like, it looked a little weird, and it probably would have been better if they had somebody with an eye to integrate the interior design with the fact that there is a big rock in there. Like practically speaking, they mentioned on the show that the rock actually provides no insulation to the elements. Just, you know, like, if you got a cold rock, it's going to radiate cold in your house. It was like, there's lots of places that, like, I wouldn't do it, but have that kind of shit, or like the old tree that goes through, you know, the room or whatever, you know, because it's mm-hmm. like 200 years old or whatever. You can make it work is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two good points. I see where both of you are coming from. I think Allison's point is like, this is the best you could find in this area if it was very important to you to live there. And then the question is like, how important is the location versus like, you know, buy a place that's smaller and has less character and that you're not going to, as you say, die of a fall in it.
And everybody almost universally, like they said, well, okay, like I know the house is shit, but let me show you the view. And like everybody does that. And then like, okay, yay, you're out in there's mountains or there's like a big river or whatever, stuff like that. But like, don't be so enamored with the mountain range that you buy a house without a fucking floor.
Yeah.
And the fact that, well, the fact that those people won in the end, this rock house, pissed me off because I really feel like they made the worst decision and got the money for it.
Yeah. So then we have finally almost a chapel. And then when we get inside and there's a lot of stained glass and it's shaped like a cross. And then they're like, it just is a house. It never was a chapel that was turned into a house. I don't understand. It has a like a curved driveway in the front. It looks like a visitor center, if not a church.
Yeah.
Allison, your feelings about the chapel house?
As a Jewish person, mm-hmm. I was made slightly uncomfortable by all the like subtly Christian vibes. I alluded to this in my name that I chose, but honestly, like the drawer situation was a deep affront to me and my sensibilities.
Can you try to explain the drawer situation for us, Allison?
You know, you think of a drawer, you think of, you know, maybe it is runners. It's generally like a rectangle or a square shape. It just mm-hmm. comes out. It's very simple. And this is, it pops out and it's like a triangle on a right angle that pivots outward instead of just coming straight out.
Yeah.
And we see these poor people's like stand mixer attachments and whatever just jammed into weird corners because they don't have like a normal shaped space to store anything in.
For no reason.
A surprisingly limited market for the rhombus drawer.
Yes. Like it takes a deeply disturbed mind to even conceive of this idea. Like of just, I don't want to do a regular drawer. I'm a cool drawer. Why? For what reason? It makes absolutely no sense. And they were like, well, it's when you look at it from above, it looks like an L and a W, like this guy. No, it's a cross. Sarah, your feelings about the church house.
It looked like a funeral home location for the Righteous Gemstones. Like it was a church.
Yes.
And as a Christian person, I was offended by it because,
Yeah.
But I was also getting... and this is not a bad thing. I was also getting when there's little chyrons that like, this room has no natural light. And the number mm-hmm. of bedrooms that have like, just they tacked fabric to the wall and then like glued it on and there's no windows and like triangular or otherwise. That particular room, I was getting very strong Jackie Taylor season one of Beverly Hills 90210 with a mm-hmm. microwave in her headboard, apparently, situation that I was like, I understand why people are sort of like, well, why isn't this in this place? Like, because it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I could almost smell this house.
Oh,
there was like a very strong, like mildewy wall-to-wall carpeting aura. With this mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, it smells like any funeral home you've been to.
Yeah. Something is being disguised. I was pretty shocked that this was not selected.
See, I thought it should have been the level house.
Absolutely.
That was selected. That was the worst to me of these three. Allison.
Okay.
I mean, I think they're all defensible choices. I will say with this one, it was less the design of the house that stuck out to me and more the fact that there's a sheer bluff and they have children.
Yeah.
like, no way, like, several soccer balls have not met their fate over that incline.
Soccer balls, companion animals.
Yeah.
This is somewhat of a tangent, but I recently toured the Stahl House here in Los Angeles, which is the opposite of an ugly house. It's strikingly beautiful, but there's a fence around the property that the dad built because basically in case any of the kids like rolled off down the hill.
Sure.
And it's just, there's very strong fencing that surrounds it. And I feel like it's unwise of the owners of this current house that they have not installed one. So I hope they do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
So how do we feel about the scoring? Because after each house is toured, and we get the tour and Retta wraps up, and then there's a little chyron and little sort of sliders of like, how ugly is it? How unsafe is it? And it's like, overall, I just felt like their scoring was not matching up with my reality.
Yeah.
Did anyone else feel that way?
Yeah, I didn't really pay that much attention to the number part of it because I was very firm in my own beliefs of like what I could see with my eyes.
Sure. So.
I got the impression that whoever won was chosen with an eye to, are the renovators actually going to want to do this?
Yes.
A house in the second episode that is like a bunch of cubes came together and made a house and and then they just tried to spackle angles on it. And it would be just a nightmare to even approach. And to me, that was obviously the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. But it didn't win. And the one that won was like, it just needed a non-demo renovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And choose a house that can be transformed for that amount of money.
Yeah.
In a sort of
for sure.
Camera ready way.
Yeah. That's a
and
good point.
And the levels upon levels house needed to be gutted.
Yes.
I was going to ask what the professional that you are married to thinks of these kinds of shows.
He avoids them. This is something that I, you know, have to watch in the privacy of my office where the walls go all the way up.
He doesn't want to take his work home. It is time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
So last week when we talked about frogging colon Hider in my house, I mentioned that Lifetime had also made a scripted movie called Hider in my house and that I would watch it and report back. I did and I am and I'm going to spoil the whole thing because you're not going to watch it. You should not. Molly, I'm not going to say any actors' names because they're all complete nobodies and are terrible, is a writer. Her best-selling novel has come out recently enough that she's still doing readings, and she made so much money off it that she has bought her first apartment, but not so much money because it's also a plot point to Allison's earlier point that she got it at a suspiciously low price. She moves in with her sister, Bella. They immediately start noticing weird things happening. Bella's room is unusually cold. There's a light fixture that doesn't work. Things move from where Molly left them. And at the same time, a vaguely creepy-looking guy in ill-fitting clothes seems to be following Molly on the street, and we learn that her book is a very lightly fictionalized version of her own recent experience with a stalker. Also, shortly after Molly moves into her new neighborhood, she has a meet cute on the street with a guy named Kyle. She has enough tradecraft knowledge to have him walk her home to a different building and then wait for him to go around the corner and walk out in the opposite direction. But the viewer sees that he sees her do it and just smiles like, oh, she's smart. Good for her. Whatever. He also spots a flyer for one of her readings and then shows up to it, asks her out. Her sister convinces her to go. He walks her home to her actual building and tells her about a weird story that happened in the apartment where she now lives. A family one day just fully disappeared. No one knows what happened to them. And she's like, wait, then who sold me this place? But the movie kind of hand waves that. And the less cute guy who was following her turns out to be a cop who wants to talk about the cold case. She and Kyle end up boning. When he gets up in the night, he also notices and peers at a draft in the bathroom all by himself, no one else watching. Remember that for later. We're 5/8 of the way through this stupid thing before Molly even pries off the cabinet in the bathroom and sees there's a person-sized hole gouged in the wall behind it and weird noises. Long story short, Kyle is Ethan, the disturbed son of the family that disappeared. The only person on earth who loved him was his mother, and after she died, his dad was going to sell the place and put Ethan in a home, but Ethan killed him instead, happened to discover a bricked up, like, gap in the walls of the building that led to an old elevator shaft that to the basement no one ever goes in somehow. And he dropped his dad's corpse down there and started living in the walls. Also, when she goes in looking for him, she sees that he stole a copy of her book, where I was like, well, that's nice. He's a fan. But anyway, he threatens Bella's life. So Molly pretends she's going to share the apartment with him and then drops him down the shaft and everything's okay. And this is the subject of her second wildly successful book. Questions. How did the extremely disturbed Ethan learn how to act normal enough to fool Molly after living in walls? Why did a former stalking victim never Google this guy? Why did he tell her the story of her apartment when he was in it, literally? Why is Molly's editor up her ass about coming up with her next idea when her last book just came out? Obviously, these are all rhetorical questions. The lead actresses are, like, porn setup level bad at acting. Like, such flat line deliveries on everything. The extras are also bad. When Molly's doing a reading about this horrific crime, they've all apparently decided the reaction is to grin at her in delight, like she's reading from a, you know, a book of humorous essays. They should have made a movie about the Hawaii stalker with the human centipede plans that we talked about from last week, but no one at Lifetime asked us, and that is Hider in my house. 1.5 hours, I'll never get back. For my plugs, Katie Rich of Vanity Fair and Joe Reed of this podcast often, and this had Oscar buzz, are doing a trivia contest to raise money for the abortion funds, National Network of Abortion Funds, perhaps. That's one of many they're supporting. And the way that you can play this trivia is by emailing proof of donation to an abortion fund to movietriviasometimesalways@gmail.com. This will be linked in the show notes. They have enlisted several trivia team captains for this, including past guests of this show, Roxana Haddadi, the aforementioned Richard Lawson, Chris V. File, Taylor Cole, and currently on this podcast, Sarah D. Bunting and me.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to do this for a very, very worthy cause on August 14th, go, just as I said, movietriviasometimesalways@gmail.com with your proof of donation, and that will enter you for a chance to play trivia on that day. And for my secondary plug, Marta Kaufman has been spending a lot of time recently. She's the co-creator of Friends, apologizing for things they got wrong on Friends. And I made a list for VanityFair.com of other Friends things they should apologize for. And this is a couple of weeks old now, but it's new to you. So we'll link that in the show notes as well.
Allison, what do you have for us today?
I have a little new show by the name of Rap Shit. It is on HBO Max. It is a half hour, and it is the follow-up of creator Issa Rae to Insecure. So it comes with a very high level of interest baked in. And for those that aren't familiar with the setup, it is essentially Issa Rae adapting and fictionalizing the real life story of the Miami rap duo City Girls, which has a very dramatic story of their longtime friends who broke out. One of them had never rapped before, with an early single. And then while they were blowing up, one of them had already been sentenced to 2 years in prison for credit card fraud, which just creates like a very interesting tension. And what Rap Shit really looks like in practice, which I wrote in my review for TheRinger.com, is it's essentially kind of like the straight sitcom version of Atlanta, which is not a bad thing at all. It's more like Atlanta has this setup that you think lends itself to kind of like, you know, two misfit buddies clawing their way up one by one. And in practice, Atlanta turned out to like not be a very plot dependent show at all. And
gently put.
Yes. more so than ever in this most recent season. Mm-hmm. But Rap Shit is kind of like, well, what if we did dedicate like an entire episode to getting a song played at the club? What if we did dedicate an entire episode to just like finding a beat for our freestyle that we did when we were drunk in someone's car, which I really enjoyed. And I think it has a lot in common with Insecure for the many, many, many fans of that show. It's obviously based in a female friendship between two Black women that is really nice and complicated. I really love that, unlike with City Girls, these two aren't actually like friends at the start of the show. They just kind of know each other. And the way they get reconnected is that one just hits the other up out of nowhere for like emergency childcare, mm-hmm. which is such a good introduction to like what world these people are swimming in, what their priorities are, what they want out of this. And it's very canny about the fact that these are two people who are like using rap to get further in life. And they're not made to seem like cynical because of that. It's just made a very organic extension of their desires. And I've noticed the reception to this has been like surprisingly muted, just given the resumes of everyone involved. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's really worthwhile. And I'd really like to shout out the two leads, Aida Osman and Chameleon, who are so well cast, as Aida's character is a little stiffer. She's the one who is already in rapping, but does these very boring raps about slash as the concept of student loans. And her partner, played by Mia, played by Chameleon, is the one who has never rapped before, but like is already kind of an Instagram influencer, like OnlyFans hustler, like has a lot of jobs and just understands image making and, you know, how being a rap star is so much more than just rapping. And I think it has really smart commentary on the music industry while also just being like a very watchable sitcom-y weekly hijinks show about female friendship.
Amazing. I haven't gotten to it yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
For my plugs, as I mentioned, I reviewed Rap Shit for The Ringer, where you can read all of my reviews and whatnot. I'm going to be covering the second season of Industry coming up. I have a little piece coming out this week about, you know, the recent cancellations of Sam B and Desus and Miro, although that's less cancellation, obviously, but mm-hmm. just what that kind of impact on the late night industry. And so I'm regularly there. I recently appeared on the wonderful podcast Criticism is Dead, and I'm always on Twitter. So you can find me there.
Fantastic. We'll link all that in the show notes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I finally got around to watching and reviewing Black Bird for my True Crime Review newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. The premise of that is that convicted drug dealer Jimmy Keane, who is played by Taron Egerton, was recruited by the feds to elicit a confession from suspected serial killer Larry Dwayne Hall, played by Paul Walter Hauser. And then he could get his sentence commuted. The reason that everyone really was talking about Blackbird, though, is that Jimmy Keane Sr. is played by Ray Liotta. I have not read In With the Devil, which is the crime noir that Apple TV Plus's limited series Blackbird is adapted from. And I also haven't watched past the first episode of Blackbird, but because I had promised readers that I would review this mofo ages ago, I just forged ahead, and after 1 hour, I have the information that we all need, to wit, that it is good, and I recommend it, and it's not just because of the camera's decision to linger on Edgerton's butt or his extensively prepared lats, although I am the opposite of mad about those things. I am a little weirded out about how much he looks like Casey Simasco in certain shots. And having not really seen Edgerton in anything else prior to Blackbird, I wasn't totally sure what to expect. But he, like the production generally, is making a lot of unexpected choices right from the jump. The story, as you understand it, is going to have certain beats because this is a true crime genre story. But the writing doesn't always get to the beats in the way that you think. It doesn't always take the route that you're expecting. The writers and the actors took the time to think about these genre cliches that viewers expect to see and to create the scenes like new. It's not like there's no trite elements. Greg Kinnear's detective character comes upon a crime scene and there's like a red Converse high top tipped over in the dust. Like, okay. But generally speaking, it is stylish and watchable, but it's not self-conscious about that and isn't trying necessarily to draw your attention to it. And if you're only at the Blackbird party for Liotes, he's really good. He's in like gruff dad figure mode. My favorite Liotta, personally. His first scene here is a little bit show-offy, but he earns it. He's always been so much more interesting on screen when he's not on that Henry Hill autopilot. And this performance so far has me really feeling the loss of him and all the stuff that he had left to do. So, and it's also really good casting because Edgerton looks enough like Liotta, but not like so much that it's like the uncanny valley, this is the only reason he was cast thing. Mm-hmm. It just really is nice to see a group of professionals doing considered work in the genre and really sort of like not by numbersing the storytelling. And so, yeah, just give it a try if you're a subscriber. I think it's definitely worth your time. That is Black Bird. It is on Apple TV Plus. For my plug, again, I did review this last week for Best Evidence. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And you can also get any hardcover book that was turned into any miniseries or not at my true crime bookshop, Exhibit B Books. That hardcover discount code, which you can enter at checkout, is EXHB. It's good until 7/31, and I will link that in the show notes as well. Save 15% with that code.
All right, coming up on the Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, dropping for our Patreon supporters on Friday, it is Bake Off the Musical. Have you heard? They're making a musical out of the Great British Bake Off, and we are going to tell them how to do it. That is available to all supporters at any level at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. And then right here next week on EHG Prime, we are going to talk about the new show Uncoupled with returning guest Malcolm Venable. Don't miss that. It's time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Tara. Take it away, Tara.
Hello.
Hi.
For six seasons on NBC, Superstore told the stories of employees at the Ozark Highlands location of Cloud9, a slightly downmarket big box discount department store. I will freely admit, I wrote off the show for almost its entire run. Promos made it look like a gratingly middle-of-the-road sitcom anchored by ex-Kid in the Hall, Mark McKinney doing a weird voice, but I finally had to listen. When the 20th TV critic I respect praised it, Dave and I quickly ran through the whole series in 2020, catching up in time for its sixth and sadly final season. And when it came to Superstore's first ever canon pitch, probably not its last, I had lots of good options, but I decided on season 4, episode 6, Maternity Leave. Is it partly because Amy, who avoids intimacy with customers by wearing uniform vests with other people's names on them, happens to spend maternity leave in a Tara name tag? There are other reasons, but yes, that is possibly one of them. For context, season 3 closed with bickering coworker frenemies Amy and Jonah finally ending their will-they-won't-they arc. Not only did they, but they got down on camera, unbeknownst to them, broadcasting their fornication to all the attendees of a nationwide Cloud9 web conference. Whoopsie. They both get suspended for the infraction, and when we rejoin them in season 4, it's on their first day back. Obviously, an all-hands sexual harassment training meeting devolves into a nosy discussion about Amy and Jonah's workplace boning and their relationship going forward. They insist they're just friends, but the very last scene of the episode lets the viewer know Jonah and Amy have been dating. Yay! Complicating matters for their relationship in its earliest days is the fact that Amy also kicks off season 4 quite pregnant with her estranged husband's baby. She gives birth in season 4, episode 5, Delivery Day. And while maternity leave does traditionally follow a delivery day, things quickly take a turn for this mother and baby. Here's why I think maternity leave should be inducted into the canon. Number 1, it details how capitalism is a prison. I mean, sorry, but it does. Superstore is, no kidding, one of the most radical shows on TV. Season 1 closes with Cheyenne hiding her labor during a presentation by a Cloud9 goon on why the Ozark Highlands staff really doesn't need a union. Cheyenne then ends up giving birth in the store and asks her manager, Glenn, that's the aforementioned Mark McKinney, to let her work the next day because she needs the money. Glenn sternly tells her he has to punish her for making such a mess in the store, and that punishment is a 6-week paid suspension. The goon overhears, Glenn gets fired, the whole staff walks out in solidarity, and Dina, Glenn's enforcer of an assistant manager, fires everyone on the spot. Superstore does not have to go this hard, but it does. Maternity leave opens on Amy at home under her brand new baby, and then Glenn calls. Clip 1.
Amy, how you been?
Shh, Glenn, the baby just went to sleep.
Oh, yeah, every day's an adventure, huh? Hey, did you know that newborn girls can have a mini period? That was a surprise.
Glenn, this really is not a good time. I just got back from the hospital 3 hours ago. I'm exhausted.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, we'll just catch up at work.
Okay, I'll see you in 6 weeks.
Yeah, sure. Or today,
What?
So apparently a person doesn't qualify for leave if they worked here under a year.
I know. I've been there 15 years.
Yes, but when you were suspended for, you know, your clock was started over.
Are you kidding me?
Look, I tried to fight it. But if you don't come in, they are not going to let me get your job open.
Okay. Well, then, I guess I'll see you soon.
Okay, thanks. And try to hurry, because technically your shift started an hour ago. You were supposed to bring in donuts. A lot of people were really angry. Okay, bye-bye.
Amy is not financially able to quit in protest, and after what she experienced around the walkout, she knows better than to test Cloud9's enforcement of its policies. So she goes straight to the store, does not shower, does not even change out of her pajamas, and tries to get through her shift, expending the absolute minimum energy possible. When she starts lactating through her pajama top, she wearily tells Glenn the bathroom is disgusting and asks if she may pump in his office. At first, Glenn says yes, but when he dithers so long that Amy starts unbuttoning her top with him still in there, he suddenly remembers she can do it in the lactation room, which Amy thought was a utility closet. Well, it can be two things, or actually three, as Amy learns when her Muslim colleague Saeed enters and tells her he also needs to use the space for prayers. Yeah, that corporate goon from season one was right. Why would Cloud9 floor employees need a union to advocate for them and force the company to make basic accommodations for their most private physical needs? Between pumping sessions, which end up syncing with Saeed's calls to prayer, Amy has to work the cash while hormonally weeping and also guide her useless ex, Adam, in the care of his child, not his first, by the way. It's just after Amy is hung up on Adam that Glenn finds her on the floor. Clip two.
You okay?
No, Glenn, I'm not okay. I am dealing with a lot today.
I know you are, and I feel terrible about it. So I got you a pick-me-up. It's a collection of bath bombs.
Sorry, you think that a bath bomb is the answer to all of my problems?
It's not a real bomb.
Just kill yourself.
What?
Kill yourself.
Me?
No, you don't get to talk right now. I am so tired. I have slept 90 minutes in 3 days. The lining of my uterus is coming out in clumps. I have hemorrhoids so big that my doctor looked at my and said, whoa. Have you ever had a doctor look at your and say that? I am wearing frozen diapers so that my doesn't fall out. Okay?
I was just...
Why haven't you killed yourself?
What? Well, I have to do some paperwork in my car.
Amy quickly regrets this outburst, but not too intensely, given how tired she is. Clip three.
I probably shouldn't have told Glenn to kill himself.
Probably not.
It's not like I thought this was going to be easy. I just didn't think it was going to be this hard. I'm on day two, and I have nothing left to give. Aren't you going to tell me some inspiring story about how you made it through Shakespeare camp without a dialect coach or something?
We were a scrappy ragtag group, but in the end, we really tamed that shrew.
There it is.
Honestly, I don't really have any advice. I've never done anything remotely as hard as what you're doing. I'm sorry if that doesn't make you feel any better.
Weirdly, it kind of does.
Irritating his colleagues by showing off his education and or social awareness is a hallmark of Jonah's character, but Amy is on a level he will never understand, and he knows enough to just shut the fuck up for once. This situation is hell for Amy, her new baby, her family, and, way at the bottom of the list, for Jonah as her partner, but they all have no choice but to get through it. Meanwhile, Amy and Jonah's colleague Dina has also just given birth as a surrogate for Glenn and his wife, and since she has manager-level Cloud9 health insurance and maternity leave and isn't actually raising the baby she just delivered, she has the luxury of being bored, bossing her punching bag Sandra around the store via FaceTime and forcing her to construct a wearable rig for the iPad Dina's on so that she can remotely keep tabs on the store at the expense of Sandra's bodily autonomy. I assume Dina and Sandra are siloed in their plot as offsite tyrant and meat puppet, respectively, and that we never see Amy jealously confront Dina because pitting Amy against Dina would let the true villain, a violently unjust system, off the hook. And by the way, if you're an American resident who either has children or is thinking about having children here, what I don't advise is looking up other countries' parental leave policies, like national government policies that everyone gets generally on top of universal health care, because the envy might send you sobbing like Amy at the cash. I realize everyone on this podcast and everyone listening to it already knows, but I'm going to say it anyway. There is rhetoric regarding the protection of the unborn, and there's the reality of what resources are available to support living children and their living parents. And the gap between those two things is approximately the size of Jupiter. Number two, around Amy's trauma, we still get store hijinks. Think Amy's obvious full body exhaustion and the grip she is barely keeping on her sanity will stop Cheyenne and Mateo making it their mission to get Amy to reverse her decision to call the baby Parker? Think again. Clip four.
Parker. She's just setting that kid up for failure.
Totally. Sophomore year, there was a girl in my class named Wanda that was getting cyberbullied. The guidance counselor was just like, yeah, your name's Wanda, but she's the mom.
So if you saw a woman beating her child, would you say she's the mom and walk away? Or would you do something about it?
I mean, I would probably do nothing, but I would want to do something.
There is an innocent child whose name is Parker. Are you just going to walk away?
Not this time.
Understanding their target customer, Cheyenne and Mateo don't try to convey their messaging with mere conversational hints and nudges. They make a PowerPoint deck for Amy to endure at lunch. Clip five.
As you know, we love the name Parker.
Oh, love it so much. And we found out a few fun, interesting facts that we thought you might want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that the name Parker literally translates to park keeper? So in other words, a homeless person.
Sleep on the street.
I don't know that anybody's making that connection.
Not to your face, they won't.
The name Parker also brings to mind the snobby, rich, evil character in an 80s movie.
Hey, nerds. I'm Parker, and I'm going to throw you guys in a dumpster.
Yeah.
But, Mateo, what about Parker Posey?
Smash cut into the next scene after that, but shout out to the razor-sharp editing on that staged interjection. Meanwhile, Jonah can't be too solicitous of Amy, even today, since they haven't officially gone public with their relationship. So when he's not checking in on her, Jonah and Garrett convince Glenn to let them interview the candidates for a seasonal associate position, Glenn himself having already hired a violent loon who doesn't believe in shoes. Garrett and Jonah meet Penny, played by Eden Cher of The Middle, and take an instant dislike to her. Clip six.
The thing you have to understand about me is I have a great sense of humor.
It seems that you do have a lot of retail experience.
Oh, no. Everything on that resume is a lie. I'm kidding. You two should have seen your faces.
You don't really have an off switch, do you, Penny?
I don't. But I did work at a PDQ mart for 2 years. I'm not afraid of hard work. Kind of a workhorse.
We'll let you know.
Oh, could you actually let me know today? I have another job offer.
An offer I can't refuse.
I also do impressions.
We're gonna pass.
Yeah, big time pass.
Just a medium-sized pass.
But after a montage of terrible applicants, guy who can't decide which of two chairs to sit in, guy who's vaping, guy with a swastika tattoo badly disguised as a stick figure tennis player, they realize they may have been too hasty dismissing Penny and call her back, convincing her to give up the job she just accepted. Clip seven.
Well, that sounds great, but I already told the plasma donation center I would start Monday.
What?
Oh, no.
You don't want to do that. Those kids are dicks.
They're never going to value you the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
When you're here, you're family.
Well, that is Olive Garden, but we are a family.
Of course, not only does Penny prove to be about 100 times more annoying than she was in her interviews, but then a late applicant shows up. Clip eight.
Unfortunately, the last spot has been filled.
Ah, sucks. Got caught up in a flame war with some guy on Fortnite. Totally lost track of time.
You know what that's like.
Well, here's my resume. Ignore the useless philosophy degree. I guess you can keep it on file or throw it away as soon as I walk out of here. I'll never know.
Hey, there's nothing on here I should know about, like a swastika tattoo or something, right?
No.
God, he's perfect.
Yeah, you're cool, dude.
Thanks, guys. I feel like your bar is a little bit low, but feels really nice to hear. If you need anyone, just give me a call.
Beep, beep, beep. Go back, pick up any go back for robot truck.
That is Future, the other two star Drew Tarver as Lonnie, and meeting him, given that he has video gaming in common with Garrett and is in every other respect a new Jonah, convinces Garrett and Jonah to fire Penny and hire Lonnie instead. Anyway, clip 9.
You said we were a family.
Yeah, we did, and we are, but families split up. Happens all the time.
This could have been a lot darker, Jonah and Garrett toying with a prospective employee as capriciously as the corporation toys with all its employees, if the episode didn't immediately establish that Penny is very experienced and in demand and will have options. Other employees Cloud9 disposes of are not always so lucky. Anyway, Lonnie ends up peering in the middle of the store, apparently for no reason. Hiring is hard. And finally, they actually are a family, kind of. Amy ends her shift hanging by the thinnest of threads, but she still knows she can't leave things with Glenn on why haven't you killed yourself, and stops by his office to apologize. Glenn can't believe he thought he could solve all her problems with bath bombs and has come up with something even better. 6 weeks of maternity leave? No, it's a puppy. Only Glenn could think the right gift for the struggling mother of an infant is essentially another infant who's never really going to grow up. True, your coworkers are your coworkers and not your family, no matter how many of your company's union-busting guest speakers try to tell you otherwise, but this episode shows us Cloud9 staffers' love for each other. Cheyenne and Mateo's name-changing crusade is sincere, or as sincere as they can be. Glenn's gift for Amy is objectively idiotic, but also clearly heartfelt. And the truest proof of Amy's love for Glenn is that she not only doesn't scream at him more about the puppy, but keeps her shell-shocked expression turned away from him. Maternity leave not only shows us Superstore's female lead on what is probably one of the worst days of her life, it demonstrates that the terrible requirements of her unremarkable job are the exact reason that day is as bad as it is. It's also, at turns, funny and mean and sweet, and an excellent example of what makes the show so extraordinary. I hope you won't ignore it like that interstitial shopper ignored the raccoon eating produce, and that you will induct it into the canon.
Thank you, Tara. Allison, would you like to go first?
Sure. I love the show. I hope I was one of the TV critics you respect who convinced you to watch it. Yeah, I mean, it is a workplace sitcom that is so perfectly tailored to the tonal and ideological needs of telling an office-type story about the working class. Creator Justin Spitzer is an alum of The Office, and I think this is one of the best shows to kind of come out of that coaching tree. Like I said, the tone is just so well done. It is funny and like caustic without getting to that like party down level of like completely nihilistic storytelling about the customer service retail space. It like keeps the cheery, funny vibe of just a regular network sitcom, but like really expertly weaves in, you know, they've done stuff about immigration. The long-running union plot line, I mean, I forgot that Cheyenne's maternity leave took place in the wake of a union-busting meeting, but that is, like, essentially the series-long arc. Like, there is a full union campaign that starts up around, basically around the maternity leave episode. I believe it kicks fully into gear in, like, season 5. Mm-hmm. As someone who was also, like, involved in a union campaign, I thought it's just so astute to like what an incredible dramatic engine that can be. And obviously the cast is all excellent, and I think Maternity Leave is in particular a showcase for America Ferrera. But you know, when I watched the episode and it's 20 minutes, and I kind of didn't appreciate until you recounted every beat of it just how much it's able to pack in,
yeah,
in terms of stories and character beats and themes, and in addition to the commentary on maternity leave, including the like very graphic and I think necessary description of what giving birth does to your body. Mm-hmm. I think that's like the most underappreciated aspect of maternity leave is that it is physical recovery more than anything else.
Right.
I think my favorite element of it is Jonah and Garrett doing the hiring process, because these are fundamentally disempowered characters in the scope of the show. They're fundamentally like sales floor grunts. And, you know, in addition to taking down the system, and there's a larger plot line the show goes through where Amy goes into management herself and gets put in all kinds of compromising positions. And Glenn obviously stands in for that. But I think it's such a great like mini dose of what happens when people get even a little bit of power and how easily they can abuse it. Like, yeah, they totally mess with Penny's entire life by extending and revoking a job offer. And it's entirely for just selfish reasons. Like, they just want someone to hang out with, and they just want someone who they see themselves in, which is, of course, how all kinds of hiring inequities happen in the workplace all Absolutely. The time. So, yeah, I love this show. I love this episode of the show. I also hope it gets inducted into the canon.
Thank you.
Sarah.
I don't love this show. I've never loved this show. I've tried to love this show. Occasionally, I would go back and try it again. I think everything that Tara said in her presentation and everything that you said, Allison, in your response are correct. And I am admiring of those things and glad that people enjoy them and take things from them emotionally. But I do not connect with this show or Freira's performance. I just don't. I just find it off-putting. I have tried to figure out why. I have tried to force myself to like the show. I don't. That said, there were a lot of great lines in this episode. There were a lot of great, like, surrealistic flourishes. Like, she just walks out with the puppy. I mean, and also there's a puppy. I think that her rant about the physical endurance trial that she's going through is on point. There were a lot of well-timed lines. Colton Dunn, who plays Garrett, is a star. His timing is really good. And again, I took a couple runs at the show because I love Ben Feldman, but there's just something about it. I wish I knew what it was. The raccoon shot was hilarious. There's a pretzel salad reference that made me laugh, but I have no context for whether this is like a leading episode among its brethren, because all of the episodes are sort of like, this is like a B+ and not for me. So, great presentation. I'm sure it's a great show, and I'm the, you know, management asshole here, but yeah, I'm just not, I mean, I don't think my vote is going to matter, which is good, but yeah, you know, nothing against presentation or fans of the show, just yeah, I'm not, I don't know. I don't like the show. I don't know why. At me. I can take it. Dave.
Well, the problem is, as a representative management on this program for this, Sarah, you get 3 votes and we only get 1. So actually, whatever you say goes here. So
as God intended.
I would put this in the canon just because it is such a good representative episode of a show that really is, like, in the climate when it aired and continues to be pretty subversive for a network TV show, and to put all the things it puts out there and to package them all into, to slyly package it all into, you know, a familiar office workplace comedy, I think is, was and is brilliant. And I think there's, obviously there's funnier episodes than this, but this one I feel speaks to the DNA of the show and all the parts that go into the show as a whole, as an aggregate, all in one episode. I will say that the one thing that I will never get over is the terrible Kermit the Frog impression that continues to be Glenn's voice in the show. I can't get over it. I hate it every time.
I agree.
It just does not work for me, has never worked for me. I never became comfortable with it, and it always sort of takes me out. But, you know, these are the sacrifices we all as TV viewers have to make from time to time, and I'm not above doing that. Mm-hmm. So let's make this official. Allison, yay or nay? Canon worthy?
Hard yay.
All right. Administrative liaison, Sarah D. Bunting.
That I may be, but I'm also no scab. I'm not crossing the line. I think you make a good point about it being representative, so I am also going to vote yay.
All right, and I will say
solidarity now.
I feel like we bullied Sarah into something here, but we'll
sit
to it.
Say, but I'll take.
That means Superstore Season 4, Episode 6, Maternity Leave. You are hereby inducted into the extra hot gray canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, it's Abbott Elementary. While we were off, it got nominated for a whole bunch of Emmys for its freshman season. Cheryl Lee Ralph, Janelle James, Quinta Brunson, who also created the show, and now I can't remember his name. Everybody Hates Chris. David Gregory Williams, I think, or the other way around. Sorry. All got nominated for acting. And this series also got nominated for Best Comedy Series. And there's more news lately, all in the past week. It got a full season order for its sophomore season. It is continuing to raise money for Real Teachers Classroom wish lists at Comic-Con. And William Stanford Davis, who played Mr. Johnson, the janitor, is going to be a series regular in season two. So great news about a great show. We love to see it.
And loser of the week, Sarah?
Copaganda. So yeah, Live PD Quasi Revival on Patrol Live had its Reels with a Z premiere delayed due to a technical glitch, as Tara put in parens in our doc. Great job, secret Antifa crew member, teehee. Eventually, it came back online after like 71 minutes, but it still had a very strong opening. As someone who writes a true crime review newsletter, I have been bombed by PR materials about how impressive this was by Reels standards. But yeah, this technical glitch is the least Dan Abrams deserves after fluffing Chris Cuomo's podcast. Yeah. Fuck both those guys.
All right, everybody. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We discuss ugliest home in America's curb appeal before going around the dial with stops at Hider in My House, Blackbird, Rap Shit, and Nothing From Me. I'm saving it for next week. Oh boy, you're going to be overwhelmed. Tara sold one copy of Superstore's Maternity Leave for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Meredith. Next up, Bake Off musical on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime Uncoupled. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole. And on behalf of Tara Ariana.
Beep, beep, beep.
Sarah D. Bunting.
You didn't tame this shrew.
And Allison Herman.
It's good to be humbled.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Delete that. Delete that!
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.